The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the National Geographic and the New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, writer Rolf Smith shares how a dive team helped to solve the mystery of a ship that vanished off the coast of modern-day Croatia more than 1,000 years ago. His story, Lost and Found, is found in the April 2026 issue of National Geographic. So let us begin. It was the site of a large bronze medieval cauldron lying on the seabed among some moldering old ship's timbers that first piqued Igor Maholchek's interest. Then head of the Department for Underwater Archaeology at the Croatian Conservation Institute, the state agency that looks after the nation's cultural resources, Maholchek ran a small team that in 2014 had been diving around some recently identified shipwrecks. This particular vessel had gone off down the coast of Milžet, one of Croatia's southernmost Adriatic islands, and he wanted to see if there were any clues that might be worth further investigation. The wreck itself wasn't exactly a surprising discovery. Milžet lies along one of antiquity's main east-west sea trade routes connecting Italian hubs like Ravenna and Venice with Constantinople, now Istanbul, and points east. Over the years, archaeological surveys of the seabed around the picturesque island, with its Roman ruins and the ancient harbor of Polis at its western tip, had yielded more than 24 old wrecks, ranging from the remains of a Roman ship from the 2nd century BC to that of a 16th century AD Venetian merchantman laden with rare Ottoman ceramics. But even in an area relatively littered with historical wrecks, something about the cauldron told Maholchek that this was different than the others. Now, the presence of the old cauldron, together with the scatter of amphora, large two-handled pots used since antiquity for transporting wine and olive oil lying around, suggested that the lost vessel was a Byzantine ship, which would be an extremely rare find in the Adriatic Sea. During his decades-long career, Maholchek and his team had found only one other Byzantine wreck, also off Milžet. But that one had been dated from the 11th century A.D. Judging by the shapes and styles of the amphora he saw at the bottom, this latest discovery was much older, possibly from the late 7th or early 8th century, part of an intriguing period historians used to refer to as the Dark Ages, when the fortunes of the Byzantine Empire were at a low point, and when some historians believe that the Adriatic was an impoverished backwater virtually devoid of shipping. Yet here was a Byzantine cargo ship lying on the seabed, some 130 feet below the surface. The prospect of excavating the submerged relic was too good an opportunity to pass up, Maholchek says, recalling his initial excitement. Today, after a decade of painstaking progress, Maholchek and his team have uncovered something more astonishing than they could have ever imagined, a rich trove of artifacts that has not only opened a valuable window into travel and trade in the Adriatic at a time when written records were nearly blank, but also revealed a glittering golden mystery. Beyond the predictable objects like anchors and cooking implements, the team recovered a collection of exquisite masculine jewelry, gold buckles, pendants, belt strap ends, and a gold signet ring they believe bears the likeness of Emperor Heraclius, who ruled Byzantium from 610 to 641, a collection that appears to have been the property of a wealthy and well-connected person aboard the ship. Who was he? Where was he headed, and for what purpose? The search to answer such tantalizing questions is beginning to give historians a glimpse into an empire facing tumultuous times. Whatever was going on here, this was no normal trading venture, Maholchek says. Whatever the mission was, the people conducting it never got beyond Mulchett before disaster overtook them, perhaps in the form of a local weather phenomenon known as the Borah, a katabatic wind that forms in the mountains. Running along this stretch of coast, the Borah can strike with little warning, roaring down the mountainsides like an avalanche of dense cold air. Within minutes, it can turn a calm sea into a maelstrom of heaving waves and hurricane-force gusts. Judging by the position of the wreck, Mulchett believes the captain was trying to reach the sheltered harbor at Polis when his ship was overwhelmed. Jump forward to a summer day in the 21st century, and it's hard to imagine Mulchett as the scene of such tragedy and loss. With its blue waters and unspoiled landscapes, it's widely considered one of the world's most beautiful islands. While the fickle Borah wind slowly contributed to the collection of shipwrecks throughout the region, the wreckage has been left undisturbed by a quirk of Iron Curtain elitism. For much of the 20th century, Mulchett was largely reserved for use by the Yugoslav military, which meant the wrecks could not be picked over by sport divers, at least not civilian ones. After the breakup of Yugoslavia in the early 1990s, Mulchett became a protected archaeological zone. It's a paradise for underwater archaeologists, Mulchett says. Despite the potential trove of underwater evidence, excavating the Byzantine wreck was not for the faint of heart. The ship's remains lay scattered over a steep and rocky seabed at a depth that required the archaeologists to move carefully during each extremely limited dive. For safety reasons, divers could spend just over half an hour a day at the site. What's more, being short of funds, the team could afford to visit the wreck for only a couple of weeks each summer. This meant that the typically exacting process of underwater archaeology, carefully scanning the area with metal detectors, excavating items from the silt, plotting objects on a grid, and building a 3D map of the site, took even longer than normal. At first, Mulchett might have expected to unearth the workaday world of an early medieval coastal trader hauling olive oil, wine, and fish sauce from port to port up the Dalmatian coast. But during their third season of diving, the team turned up something that flipped the narrative on its head. On a morning descent near one of the deeper parts of the site, landmarked by a couple of anchors poised on the edge of a steep drop-off, underwater archaeologist Pavla Degovich noticed a curious shape in the sand. Sweeping away the silt with his hand, he stared spellbound through his mask. It was an exquisitely crafted golden buckle, intricately decorated with birds pecking at grapes from a cornucopia. "I found many beautiful artifacts in the course of my career," Degovich says, "but never anything like this." After logging the find on his dive slate, an underwater notepad, and recording its position, he lifted it carefully from the sand and kicked his way to the surface to show his startled colleagues. Over the following six summer diving seasons, the team slowly teased more secrets out of the wreck. They have so far recovered a total of four belt sets, ornamental buckles with matching belt strap ends, all in gold, plus a golden buckle encrusted with rubies, emeralds, and pearls, the likes of which, Mulchett says, have never been found anywhere. They also cataloged the golden imperial signet ring and 14 solidi, or chunky gold coins, with Constantinople mint marks. Shipwrecks are time capsules, snapshots of life precisely as it was on a particular day. And in addition to the glittering assortment of jewelry and coins, the team recovered a mountain of less eye-catching artifacts, millstones, crockery, fishing tackle, even dice and game pieces used for backgammon or checkers, all parts of a puzzle that with time and much research will be used by archaeologists to tease out an untold story from an obscure past. Of the ship itself, little remains, just a few waterlogged remnants of its keel, ribs, and planking. But it was enough for Mulchett and the team to surmise it was fairly standard mid-sized cargo ship of the time, about 60 feet long with a capacity of around 60 tons. Judging by the dates on the coins, the types of amphora, and the workmanship of the jewelry, researchers have refined the dating of the wreck to the first half of the 8th century. Its location, on the southeastern approach to the harbor at Polis, indicates it was probably sailing north up the Adriatic when disaster struck. Maholczyk thinks the jewelry and gold belonged to someone wealthy and well-connected aboard the ship, which probably started its fateful voyage in Constantinople and may have been heading for Ravenna, some 300 miles away. Another clue to ponder, the number of amphora found in the wreck, about 100, was only a fraction of what archaeologists would normally expect to find on a ship that size, indicating that something other than bulk cargo was funding the expedition. The dawn of the 8th century was a troubled time in the history of one of the world's great empires. Constantinople, the Byzantine capital, was dedicated in 330 and endured for over 1,000 years until it was overrun by the Ottoman Turks in 1453. Its inhabitants don't think of themselves as Byzantines, but as Romans, considering the empire continuation of an ancient Rome. During the centuries following the fall of Rome in 476, the fortunes of the Byzantine Empire ebbed and flowed before rising to a brief golden age under Emperor Basil II in the 11th century. The latter half of the 7th century was one of the gloomier times. The previous 100 years were characterized by plague, famine, and long, destructive wars against the Persians, leaving the Byzantine Empire in no state to resist the astonishingly swift rise of Islam, whose seemingly unstoppable armies had seized vast territories in the Middle East, Asia, and North Africa after the Prophet Muhammad's death in 632. The fortunes of the Byzantine Empire were still at a low ebb around 700, by which time the empire had been stripped of its richest provinces by the all-conquering Arabs to the south. Its great seaborne trading days, when wine produced in the Byzantine province of Gaza could be purchased in Britain, and the harbor of Theodosius in Constantinople bustled with ships carrying grain from Egypt, seemed to be over for good. The Adriatic virtually disappears from the written records between the 7th and 8th centuries, with little mention of travel or trade on its waters in Latin or Greek. "It's a blank," says Francesco Boi, a medieval scholar and associate professor of humanities at the Ca' Foscari University of Venice, who suspects that far more was going on in real life than written records imply. That's why the discovery of this ship is so exciting, he says. One possibility is that the ship was on a diplomatic mission, bearing gifts of these lavishly decorated belt sets for parties along the Adriatic they hoped to keep friendly to the Byzantine cause. You can see why a stylistic connection between the Byzantine Empire and the Avar Empire, says Falco Dame, professor of early medieval archaeology at the University of Vienna and scholar of Byzantine-era belt sets. One of the sets from the shipwreck is identical to a set found in an Avar grave that I purchased for the Rheinisch Germanisch Central Museum in Mainz when I was director there, he said. The two sets are so similar they could have been made in the same workshop, he adds. The sets, some of which were antiques even at the time of the voyage, appear to have been a collection. Their dates span almost the entirety of the 7th century, Dame says. This is very unusual and makes it difficult to interpret historically. The newest of them, the one with the birds and grapes motif, dates roughly to the 8th century, not long before the time of the ship's sinking. The styling is also distinctly Byzantine. The Avar seldom used birds as motifs, and when they did use them, it was generally an eagle, he says, but the Byzantines loved birds. It's possible, Dame says, that this belt, or belt set, was the personal property of the ship's owner. Such gilded accessories were a common way to carry favor in this part of the world. Golden belt sets, even the signet ring of Heraclius, was precisely the sorts of gifts a Byzantine emperor would present, says Peter Saras, professor of Byzantine studies at Cambridge University. One recipient of such elegance was a prince named Huanser, who ruled Caucasian Albania in the mid-7th century. To secure the prince's loyalties, Byzantine Emperor Constans II gave him a swag of ornate accessories, including a belt buckle set that had once belonged to Constans' grandfather, Emperor Heraclius. It would have been such a prized gift, Sarah says. Anything associated with Heraclius was especially highly regarded. A signet ring from the emperor would even be grander. It would be like the British government today giving Winston Churchill's pocket watch to the leader of a country with which they wanted to stay on good terms, he says. Complicating the narrative around the older belt sets is the fact that Mahaljik and his team also found goldsmithing equipment in the ship's wreckage. Scales, weights, and crucibles, and pools of mercury, an element used by smiths to extract gold from alloys. Were these simply old-fashioned pieces meant to be melted down and turned into newer, more modern styles, Dame asked? Was someone on board planning to sell these items or traveling as some sort of emissary? We have to use our imaginations, he says. It's this storytelling potential that intrigues the archaeologists far more than the glint of gold. Until Mahaljik and his team found the belt sets off Mulgit, such objects had been known almost exclusively from grave sites. We simply do not have much evidence of these things on the move, just their eventual deposition, says Justin Ledwanger, associate professor of archaeology and classics at Stanford University. Ledwanger is keen to investigate the economic connections that entangled the empire at the time. To my mind, this is the most important shipwreck of the period, he says. Preliminary studies of the amphora found with the wreck suggest the ship may have traveled far more extensively around the eastern Mediterranean than historians might have assumed. We're finding connections with southern Italy and northern Africa, Ledwanger says. This raises interesting questions where people from Byzantium were still trading directly with North Africa even after the Islamic conquest. Much of the surviving text from the 7th century was written by clergy. Between the rise of Islam and the decline of the empire, they tended to take a bleak view of the times, Ledwanger says. We are left with all these descriptions of sacked and abandoned cities, yet as scholars have found in Western Europe after the fall of Rome, there was still culture as well as commerce. The Dark Ages weren't really all that dark, he says. More research remains to be done on the artifacts that Mahaljik and his team have brought up from the seafloor. But the idea that sometime around 750, a Byzantine cargo ship could have been sailing north on a diplomatic mission, perhaps bearing gifts for an influential ally, is certainly a new historical theory to ponder. And the details surrounding such a voyage, how the trip could have taken months, how the crew probably passed the time doing mundane things like fishing and playing backgammon, all help humanize the stakes and drive home the emissary's ambition. The researchers recently shared plans to return to the site this summer to see what else they might uncover. Finding all these artifacts brings mixed emotions, archaeologist Degunyich says. Feelings of awe and respect for the passengers and crew who obviously ended their journey on the rocky shores of Mulgit, and the pleasure of being able to tell their story, a story that would otherwise have been lost forever. Wow. Amazing story there. Well, our next story is kind of interesting as well, and a little bit more up-to-date, shall we say more contemporary. It's titled, Your Chia Pet's Roots Are Deeper Than You Think. Now, this article by Sam Keen is found in the April 2026 issue of National Geographic. And as the title page presents, long before the campy ceramic planters were all over TikTok or even TV airwaves, they served as Mexican ceremonial artifacts with a different wow factor. Well, let's find out more as we deal with this story. If you were alive and channel surfing in the 80s and 90s, you almost certainly remember the jingle, Cha-Cha-Cha-Chia. Today, some 50 years since Chia Pets first hit shelves in the United States, the funny little planters are still going strong. Available early in a menagerie of cutesy animal shapes, including sheep, turtles, kittens, and teddy bears, the brand hit the pop culture stratosphere with that all-time catchy ditty, then branded out into licensed characters, thanks Bugs Bunny and Bart Simpson, in the early 2000s. And while the growing process is unchanged, soak the porous clay figurine in water, spread on a paste of seeds, and watch the sprouts cover your pet in fuzzy greenery, Chia Pets have since caught on with a whole new generation thanks to retro nostalgia, time-lapse TikTok videos, and an increasingly vast and memified catalog. Yes, you can still buy a Chia kitten, but it's in the mix with the Chia poop emoji, a Chia wrapper ice spice, and a complete set of Chia Golden Girls. 5 decades on, the kish still connects. But when Marta Turok, a Mexican anthropologist specializing in folk art, looks at a Chia pet, she sees more than a gag gift or a droll decor. Her first encounter was one at the Woolworth department store in Mexico City in the early 1990s. On the box was a clay bear with a sprouted green fur that she recognized right away as a nod to a regional religious handicraft, one she had no idea had been co-opted into a novelty knick-knack. "I thought it was crazy," Turok says, "that someone saw this as fun for kids." As Turok knows, the much-overlooked roots of the Chia pet are anything but frivolous. In the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca, terracotta animals covered in chia sprouts are a mainstay of the elaborate Semana Santa altars found in homes and churches in the lead-up to Easter. The Holy Week altars are solemn affairs set with candles, flowers, and other decorations that typically flank a weeping likeness of La Virgen de los Dolores, Our Lady of Sorrows. In the faithful, the figurines are highly symbolic, says Seattle-based ceramic artist Ro Aguilar, who is originally from Oaxaca's neighboring state of Chiapas, and has written about the tradition's significance. The green chia shoots evoke the continuation of life, Aguilar says, in anticipation of Christ's Easter Day resurrection. And the choice of animal can have meaning, too. Sheep suggest the Lamb of God, while roosters call to mind the biblical story of the Apostle Peter denying Jesus before a cock crowed before dawn. Now, bulls, goats, dogs, deer, and even elephants are all creatures one might spot on the altar these days. To make them, artisans start with a mold and a lump of moist clay, create a hollow shell of generic animal body, then add special features like legs, horns, and antlers. After the figures have dried to a leathery consistency, they're scored with a stylus or, say, a comb or fork to make grooves where seeds can settle and sprouts can anchor. After an initial firing in a kiln, the animal's heads are glazed with a dark green lacquer, then fired a second time to fuse the glaze. To Aguilar, the Semana Santa pieces are a powerful example of syncretism, the blending of different religions' traditions to produce something new. It's a historical irony that the grain-like seeds of Salvia Hispanica, or chia, play a central role in Catholic custom. The Spanish once banned the plant's cultivation because of its ties to indigenous religion. Chia seeds were a staple for many native Mexicans who pressed them for medicinal oil and ground them into flour for food. Aztec emperors received them by the ton as tribute from conquered lands, while warriors drank a sort of pre-battle energy shake made of chia flour mixed with water and agave syrup. Chia, in fact, likely gives the state of Chiapas its name, deriving from a word in the Nahuatl language, the language of the Aztecs, that describes a place where the plant grows. But for all that history and symbolism, Aguilar suggests there's still a playful side to the little animals. "They're trying to cheer Mary up," he says. "They're adorable. They're saying, don't cry." That adorableness caught the eye of the late American marketer Joseph Pettit back in 1977 when a drugstore sales rep first showed him an imported Oaxacan chia figurine. Pettit thought he could sell them in droves, so he snatched up the rights and went to Mexico to study the production process. The company he founded, which shifted production to China in 1989, says that to date it has sold more than 32 million chia pets in 11 countries. This includes one Marta Turok at that Mexico City Woolworth more than 30 years ago. Despite the bear pictured in the box, she found a turtle inside when she opened it at home. She still has it today, although she's never sprouted the seeds. She only bought it, Turok says, to teach her son about the unexpected ways that traditional products can transform modern times. What a story that. Well, we are going to hit to the final phase of our journey today. Writer Nikita Richardson is going to wind us up with how to choose a restaurant when you're traveling. This ought to be helpful, I hope. The story appeared in the December 8, 2025 issue of the New York Times. Well, everyone has different priorities when it comes to traveling. Some people just want to relax. Others want to spend a few hours in a museum or fill up their suitcase in the shopping district. And some of us care most about eating well. Out of all those options, figuring out where to dine can feel like a tougher task. There's only one Prado Museum, but there's also countless tapas spots across Madrid. The first step, well, just breathe. It's impossible to visit every amazing restaurant, cafe, or bar a city has to offer in a dozen visits, let alone in one visit. Instead, let's focus on what's important to you. The food writer and recipe developer, Carla Lally Music, once planned an entire vacation around the pursuit of great croissants. Anthony Bourdain would head straight to the central market of an unfamiliar city, calling it the best place to get a sense of what a culture loves most dear, and no doubt enduring himself to a vendor and gathering some choice recommendations. I like to spend my first afternoon on the ground scrolling through the following tab of Chic Coffee Shop's social media account. As it turns out, cool coffee shops tend to follow cool restaurants and bars. Here are some tips from well-traveled food writers on how to track down some great dining options. Whether you're the type to make reservations months in advance or play things a little more fast and loose. Ask the locals. While it is easy to make a snap judgment on a restaurant based on Google or TripAdvisor reviews, locals know the dining scene best, especially the beloved haunts where the service is great, the drinks are cold, and the table is easy to come by. Regan Stevens, a writer based in Philadelphia and co-founder of the travel guide Saltat, researches local experts before she hits the airport. She recommends restaurant critics, cookbook authors, or food tour guides. I'm seeking out the people on the ground who've lived in the destination and know it better than anyone else, Ms. Stevens says. She follows them wherever they write, their social media accounts, local publications, even Substack newsletters. Now, if you're feeling particularly brave, you can even send an email or direct message asking if they have a Google map or a list that they share with friends and family. And more often than not, the answer is yes, Ms. Stevens says. Now, this method translates well into in-person interactions. Ms. Stevens will strike up friendly conversation with a barista, a bartender, or an employee at a small shop, as long as they're not in the weeds and dealing with a barrage of customers, she said. Many are more than happy to share their favorite spots with a friendly tourist, but their personal preferred source for an accessible, delicious meal in a different city? Taxi drivers. Yep. If you were to drive somewhere right now on your lunch break, if you're about to get off work and meet your friends, she asks, where are you going? And for Lindsay Green, she's always researching the restaurant and dining critic for the Detroit Press. She seeks out restaurants for her travels and her first call of action, anywhere I ever go, she said. She saves up recommendations year-round using Instagram's bookmark function to save posts into folders organized by city. I really just try to find where real people are going, she says. She visits New York City a few times a year, so she keeps a running list of leads. Then I can refer to it whenever I'm there, she says. And as a self-identified last-minute Charlie, she said keeping a running list rather than starting from scratch makes the planning process a lot less stressful. And there we have to end today's journey of Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of a program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that website, ncreadingservice.org, or if you prefer, you may send your comments or questions via phone at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.